Some time ago, I talked with you about five dangerous religious deceptions in the world today. I think most of you were here at that time and probably can remember some of the things that we discussed. Hasn't been too long ago. The idea behind covering these is that they're dangerous from the standpoint that they can and will cause souls to be lost. Millions of people believe one or more of the things that I was talking with you about, and any one of them could directly or indirectly cost you your eternal salvation. So I said when we were talking about them that I hope that all of you are personally well inoculated against all the things we discussed, and that if any one of them seems to you to be true, that we should get together afterward in privacy and look at the Bible together. David said in Psalm 119, verse 104, "Through thy precepts I get understanding, therefore I hate every false way." And again in verses 127 and 128, "I love thy commandments above gold, yea, above fine gold. Therefore I esteem all thy precepts concerning all things to be right, and I hate every false way." This morning, the lesson I'd like to bring to you can be considered a sequel to the lesson we were just discussing. Five more dangerous religious deceptions, because after I spoke on the other one, some people said that maybe it would be good to have five more. Maybe I should just mention to you very briefly what the original five were so you'll have a context for these other five. Okay. Just real briefly, we'll just cram these in here. The fifth one that I mentioned to you before was, there are many ways to God. There are many ways to God. The idea behind that is, and these are all quotations, actual quotations that people say. Behind the idea that there are many ways to God is the concept that Christianity is just one of a number of world religions, all of which are equally valid. They are all paths up the same mountain, therefore they all lead to the same peak. And only a bigoted fool believes that there's just one way. When we explored that, we saw that it makes Jesus Christ out to be a bigoted fool, since he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me." So it's a dangerous religious deception to think that there are many ways to God. Number four, it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. Millions of sincere people sincerely believe that. But when we explored it, we saw that while sincerity is essential, in itself it's insufficient, because there are all kinds of consequences to being sincerely wrong. We saw that's true in the area of driving in traffic. We saw that it's true in the area of whether a gun is loaded or not. It's true in the chemistry lab. It's true in every area, including and perhaps especially in the area of religion. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're sincere, just is not right. Number three, there will be a second chance. Now, there have been various permutations of this idea through the years. The current one that has the most currency at this time is the left-behind premillennial theory, which teaches that you can wait until the Lord gets your attention with the rapture and then decide to believe and serve Him. And later on, you'll be saved right along with those who rose to meet the Lord in the air in the rapture that you missed. And as long as you can stay alive, you'll have at least 3.5 years, some would say 7, but you'll have at least 3.5 years to submit to the Lord as long as you can stay alive after the rapture. This is an extremely dangerous religious deception because it tends to remove motivation to obey the Lord now. We talked about that for quite some time, I think. Number two, once saved, always saved. The doctrine of the impossibility of apostasy says that once you're in a saved relationship with the Lord, you have no possibility of ever being lost, no matter what you do. Your eternal salvation is unconditionally guaranteed. No child of God can ever be lost. In our examination of this, we looked at 2 Peter 2, 20 through 22, and mentioned that there are dozens of other New Testament passages which show that it is possible for us to be lost. Indeed, if it's not possible for us to be lost, then much of the New Testament is nonsense, because it was written to help keep us from being lost. It would have been unnecessary to write it if there was no possibility of us being lost. And the number one thing that we mentioned before was that salvation is by faith only. Very, very popular religious deception in our time, that salvation is by faith only. We pointed out that the only verse in the New Testament that talks about faith only says that we're not saved by faith only, and that's James 2:24. We showed that baptism is essential for salvation and that Paul wrote in Romans 6 and Galatians 3 that we're baptized into Christ, meaning that we can't be in Christ before we're baptized. You can't come into this room right now because you're already in this room. It's absolutely impossible for you to come into this room at the moment. Only somebody out of this room can come into this room. Only somebody out of Christ can come into Christ. And if you're baptized into Christ, you were in Christ before you were baptized. So those were the five previously mentioned religious deceptions. There are many ways to God. It doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. There will be a second chance. Once saved, always saved. And salvation is by faith only. Now today, I want to mention to you five more. And since I use quotations of things people say to express the previous deceptions, I'm going to attempt to do the same thing this morning. So we'll start with number five, and I hope you all can see. If I write down here, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. 1,300,000,000 people believe that, who are alive on earth at this time. That was the number as of just a couple of years ago, but their number is daily growing. One out of every five people on earth this morning is a Muslim. And by the year 2025, it's expected that there will be 2 billion adherents to this false religion. It's the fastest growing of the major world religions, driven by high birth rates in the third world. In the United States itself, there are 7 million Muslims. It's one of the fastest growing religions in America. But I need to point out to you as we discuss this briefly that the validity of Islam does not depend on whether they're trying to kill us or not. The validity of Islam does not depend on whether we happen to like them or not. The validity of Islam stands or falls with the inspiration of the Quran. If the Quran is the word of God, then Islam is true, and we ought to accept it. If the Quran is not the word of God, then Islam collapses. And it's really just as simple as that. Now, for information about Muhammad, we're forced to go to the Muslims, since nobody else has any information about him. The non-Islamic world is dependent on Islamic sources for depictions of Muhammad's life. It seems, though, that nobody ever bothered to teach Muhammad to read or to write. Every Muslim has always contended and continues to universally insist that he was entirely illiterate all his life. I think that's an important point for something that we may get to in a few minutes. Muhammad was a fairly bright guy. He did have some financial savvy, and when he was young, he supervised trading caravans and eventually married his employer in that enterprise. His first wife was 15 years older than himself, and I think sort of a mother figure to him in many ways. Actually, Muhammad's father had died before he was born. His mother died when he was very, very young. He was then raised by a grandfather who also died when he was young, and then by an uncle who also died. So he was one of those sad, unfortunate youths that were sort of transferred around from place to place within the family, and people continued to die that were raising him. So he had a lot of issues based on that, I think. Anyway, that could or may not have something to do with who he married. But his wife, 15 years older than himself, was a huge influence on him and provided him not only with financial security, but also was there later on when he had his religious experiences to encourage him and give him confidence and help him sort out the things that he was experiencing, help him try to come to an understanding of what those things meant. Now, there was a sizable community of Jews in Arabia in the 6th and 7th centuries of the Christian era. And we can picture Muhammad as a young man on these caravan routes at night beside the campfire, sitting around with the other men and listening to the stories that were told. Unfortunately for Muhammad and for a lot of other people, the Judaism and the Christianity that Muhammad was exposed to in those 6th and 7th centuries, these were in very corrupted forms, and Muhammad could not, of course, read any source material for himself, and so he tended just to absorb like a sponge whatever came within his range. And over the 22 or 23 years later that he dictated the 114 surahs or chapters that make up the Quran as we know it today, he regurgitated a great deal of what he heard as a youth or that he'd been hearing all through the years, or he changed it to fit whatever situation he was facing at the time. Remember, if you can't read, then your source of information is what other people say to you, primarily. And Muhammad probably had no direct contact with the Bible. If he had had, he wouldn't have been able to read it anyway. The Jews in Arabia in those days were much more acquainted with the fables of the Talmud than they were with the Old Testament itself. And many of the stories in the Quran, if you've read any of it, you know this to be true, I think. Many of the stories in the Quran give the impression that there's something missing from them, almost sometimes to the point of being absolutely indecipherable. But then when you go back and look at Jewish legend, which existed in Muhammad's day, you see that the source of the story is there, and there are also additional details there to provide context and meaning as to the story as it's found in the Quran. Much of the Quran contradicts the Bible. It's constituted of minute details from Jewish folklore, and in detail after detail, where the Quran differs from the Bible, it coincides with Jewish legends that were current in Muhammad's day. Now, in the Quran, there are all sorts of chronological issues that are just sort of garbled together, apparently with no understanding on the part of the author. There are historical compressions. There are various sorts of anachronisms. Just a couple examples of the type of thing I'm talking about here. Muhammad has the Samaritans in existence about 700 years too early, historically. There's no question about where the Samaritans came from and what time they came on the scene. But Muhammad's got them in existence not understanding. He's got them in existence 700 years too early. Also in the laws of inheritance in the Quran, when you add together the percentages that the heirs are supposed to receive, you find that for some people, the sum exceeds 100% of the estate, which is absolutely impossible, of course, and the Muslims never have been able to explain that very well, but it's still in the Quran to this day. All sorts of things like this, showing that the Quran is a hodgepodge of hopeless contradiction just within itself. And when you then look at the Bible in comparison with it, we see that the Quran and the Bible are also in hopeless contradiction with each other. The Quran flits from one idea to another in a piecemeal approach with innumerable repetitions. The Quran, in other words, is exactly what we would expect from an illiterate, uninspired, self-serving man. When we look at it in that context, it's exactly what we would expect to see produced at the time that it was produced. Now, here's an interesting thing as well, and I won't take time to go into this in much detail, but the transfer of the Quran from the memories of Muhammad's followers was an uninspired process. When the Bible was put down in writing, it was written down by inspired men. But the people who wrote the Quran down were not inspired to do it, and many times they were functioning on the basis of memory, or they were functioning on the basis of little fragments that they had, putting them together in a piecemeal sort of way. Thrown together without much regard to chronology or with any system, no regard to subject even really, no regard to anything except length, perhaps. These 114 surahs which compose the Quran are a lot longer than the main chapters in the Bible, and they make the Quran about the size of the New Testament. But we've got all kinds of things crammed in there together, flitting from one subject to another. The textual evidence, even if we were to assume for a moment that the Quran is inspired, it was inspired in its original autographs, the textual evidence that could authenticate the purity of the text of the Quran has never been subjected to the kind of scholastic analysis that the Bible has been so intensively subjected to, because the Muhammadic nations would not allow this to occur. It's a hodgepodge of verses and phrases precariously pieced together by unknown and uninspired redactors. The Muslims themselves admit that there are 225 verses in the Quran canceled out by other verses that come later. Unlike the Bible, the textual integrity of the Quran lacks verification, it lacks authentication. Those who originally committed the Quran to writing were uninspired men, and they were dependent on fallible memories. The long story short, insufficient evidence has been forthcoming to demonstrate the accurate preservation of the Quran, even if we took the position that it was inspired in the first place, which we don't take. A couple other things that are important, I think, to understand about this. Muhammad never claimed to work miracles. This is an extremely important point. The Quran repeatedly makes excuses for Muhammad's inability to provide miraculous signs to support his revelations, whereas Jesus Christ was just the opposite of that. Jesus verified his teaching by his miracles, and he said on more occasions than one, "If you don't believe my words, then believe me for the sake of my works." Because And Nicodemus said it. No man can do the works that you're doing, the miracles that you're doing, except God is with him. Well, where evidence does not exist, God does not expect people to believe. God gave confirmatory miracles with new revelation just so people could believe it. And Jesus verified his teaching by his miracles. Muhammad did no such thing and seems to have been embarrassed about that. But before we close on point number 5, I need to tell you this. The greatest tension between the Bible and the Quran pertains to the person of Jesus Christ. Here we have an inexorable, permanent incompatibility that will never be bridged. The Quran depicts Jesus as a mere prophet, but if Jesus is who the Bible claims he was, then the Quran is utterly fictitious. In the area of the crucifixion, the Quran denies the historicity of the crucifixion of Jesus as well as the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. The Christian religion, after all, says in 1 Corinthians 15, as you know, that if Jesus did not rise from the dead, then Christianity itself is a false religion. But the author of the Quran not only denies the historicity here, he seems to be oblivious even to the issues. He's completely oblivious to the issue of atonement, it would seem. Muhammad sacrificed animals, for instance, and the Quran enjoins the same on the followers of Muhammad. But why would you be sacrificed? This is an issue of atonement that Muhammad seems not to have understood. The Quran seems to leave the idea that since God is God, he can do whatever he arbitrarily decides to do at any moment. Whereas the Bible teaches us that God can do nothing which conflicts with his nature or conflicts with his character. The Bible gives examples of things that God absolutely cannot do. He cannot lie, for instance. That's something you and I can do that Muhammad cannot even do. Jesus never took up the sword against anybody, and he never encouraged anybody else to do so. But Muhammad was a warrior. And the Quran endorses the advancement of Islam by physical force. The Islamic terrorists today are behaving in a way that's consistent with their own scriptures in many, many cases. But the last thing I'll say about this to conclude the point is that the revelations of Muhammad sound amazingly like the latter-day revelations of Joseph Smith Jr., the Mormon prophet, especially when the subject is polygamy. They have a lot in common on that subject. In both cases, their revelations consisted of admonishment to their wives to accept their polygamy. Muhammad consummated one marriage with a 9-year-old girl. It's a perverted system and a dangerous religious deception. But I need to go on to number 4. The present is the key to the past. The name of the religion represented by this statement is uniformitarianism. And its handmaiden is biological evolution, the general theory of biological evolution. Uniformitarianism says, we watch something and it took a certain amount of time to occur, so we assume that that much of that thing has always taken that same amount of time. In other words, present processes have always gone on at the same standard detectable process rates. So it's the philosophy of constancy. Satan invented this real early, and it's referenced in the Bible in 2 Peter chapter 3, for instance. Since the fathers fell asleep, they say, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. So uniformitarianism was here long before Lyell and Darwin and T.H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. It was already fully developed by the time that 2 Peter chapter 3 was written. Natural process and continuity. Natural process and continuity. The present is the key to the past. They look at their little piece of time, and from it draw conclusions about all of history. From a few unchanging years, they draw conclusions that change has always been unfolding very slowly and steadily. And in most cases, they don't even have any desire to put any, to take into account any catastrophic type of issues, like the global flood of Noah, just as one example. Now, the reason this is such a dangerous religious deception is this. In the New Testament, the Jew was always approached from the standpoint of the Old Testament scriptures. And you've seen this in the New Testament over and over again. The Jew was always approached from the standpoint of Jesus' fulfillment of 332 distinct predictive messianic prophecies recorded in the Old Testament. But the Jew was only about 2%, if that, of the population of the world. The other 98% or so of the world's population was approached in an entirely different way. The pagan was always approached from the standpoint of creation. Think of Acts 14. Think of Acts 17 with Paul at Mars Hill. How can you explain the creation? Paul says, God that made the world and all things therein. This was his answer to that question over and over again. A teleological argument from design. We've got it in Romans 1. We've got it all over the Bible, really. The general run of humanity in the New Testament time was approached from the standpoint of creation. And that would still be true today. So what does Satan want to convince the world of? He wants to convince the world of evolution, which in the minds of many people gets rid of a need to believe in a creative God. It doesn't really in any way get rid of that, but in the minds of many people, it does. The bottom line here is that really evolution is not the child of science. It was produced by people who want no meaning to the world, who want there to be no meaning to behavior, who want no accountability, no judgment, no God, so they can live as they wish. At its root, at its core, it's a moral issue. The Apostle Peter says that both the creation and the flood disprove uniformitarianism. While you're having the process of evolution and all those polypeptides are lining up over the process of years and years and years so that they can form something that's alive, well, here comes a flood and wipes that all out. So uniformitarianism, according to the Apostle Peter, is disproven by catastrophes like the flood. And Peter says, this they willingly are ignorant of. They're willingly ignorant of these things. You know what willingly ignorant of means, don't you? It means that they're being dumb on purpose about this. You can't say that all things continue as they have from the beginning because they obviously have not. The evidences of catastrophe are around us everywhere in the world. Look at the frozen woolly mammoths in Siberia and even in Alaska. Uniformitarianism ignores the flood. Catastrophe has made our world what it is, not uniformity. Throw a leaf out in your backyard, and how long does it take for that leaf to become a fossil? Well, it doesn't become a fossil. But if you have an earthquake, and that opens up your yard, and the leaf falls down into that crack, and then your yard slams back together, then you might have a fossil after a while. It's catastrophe, not uniformity, that explains the fossil record. One time I heard Mark Herman say on this subject, and I know a number of you know him. He's been here off and on through the years. Mark Herman, who teaches science in high school, was talking about this subject, and he made a statement that I don't think I can improve on. So when I find a statement I don't think I can improve on, I just steal it and use it. Mark Herman made the statement, oh, that we would have as much faith in God as the evolutionists have in their theory. And I think that sums it up pretty well for me as well. Unfortunately, I've talked too long about these first two, and there are three more to go. But we'll just conclude right here this morning, Lord willing, and then we'll eat a little bit and get back together this afternoon, talk about the other three. I'll conclude this morning with just a poem that I think is significant on that point. I didn't intend to include this, but since I'm concluding right here, we'll use this as introductory to the invitation. God's man is who I am, a speck of cosmic dust, a germ within a cell, a cog to turn a wheel, a link in a leaden chain. Oh no, for I have the inexpressible joy to scream, I am God's man. Not a cosmic particle, not an insignificant germ, not a mere mechanical cog, not a lifeless leaden link, for I can love and feel and think. Once more, I must repeat, I am God's man. They say I'm merely ape-like, a monkey running round. They call it evolution. One cell, some change, then man. But all the special wonder of a God-created man. I am God's man. I peel an orange and taste its citric tartness. I pick a jasmine blossom and the fragrance fills my head. I piece a poem together and find my own expression. I perceive complete fulfillment in the one I've found to love. Impossible that I just happened or developed bit by bit. I am God's man. And man became a living soul, so says the Holy Book. A universal order, a God of love, yet righteous. God created Adam. Oh, how I believe it. I am God's man. I believe in the divine origin of man and in a destiny for man which has been prescribed by divinity, so I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, and I'd like to help open the highways of hope and happiness to those who would believe in that gospel of Christ. Don't be afraid to examine your faith, but by all means be willing to examine your doubts and your questions as well. We're going to extend the Lord's invitation this morning for you to come in simple trusting faith just as you are as we stand and sing number 605.